We're not like other Athens bands. First of all, there's nothing cool about us. And we're like, I don't know, we're like these, seeing us, to me, it's like seeing like an exposed kind of raw nerve.
I'm Jeremy Powell, and here on the Peach Jam Podcast, I get to introduce you to incredible Georgia musicians, from hometown favorites you already love to brand new voices you're about to discover. It's my job to find different types of people and different types of sounds from all over the Peach State. This podcast is a mix of performances and down-to-earth conversations, all recorded live at the GPB Studios in Midtown Atlanta. On this episode, I have the honor of introducing you to legends of the Athens music scene, 5'8".
I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike. And we play in the band 5'8". We're from Athens, Georgia. And we play sort of a kind of post-punk indie rock, I would think.
I think that's a very apt description of what we do. I accept that. This guy over here is Mark. Mark Pilvinsky. And he's the director of our documentary, Weirdo is the name of it. And Mark is a fantastic and handsome human being.
They're correct about this.
They're correct about all those things, yeah. I'll take that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I've only known him for 30 years, and I'm hoping they'll get my name right at some point.
On a drive out of town, I've discovered something about myself that I'm forced to admit I never knew. A funny quirk that has taken me apart from the part of everything that all along. Frequently I find myself out of answers, and here's where I mouth an emotional sentence and try to arrange the way that you gave me and fits with my concepts of. And I'm alone and I long to be lonely. How about you?
Why is Athens, Georgia so special?
It used to be special because it was cheap. But I can't really say that anymore. It's just got a lot of talent.
It's really laid back, too. And it's got tons of clubs and lots of places to play. There's always new college students coming, you know, and art students, and there are great house parties always still going on. And I think because it's such a small town, it has this kind of, there's like a sort of like a local vibe of, you know, with the music, but there's also, you know, the bar scene is extremely just Athens. There's bars that you're never going to see anywhere else. And same with the clubs. They just have a real local history to them. And I think people are, they come because of that.
It's a town that just values art. You cannot go anywhere without seeing somebody's paintings on the wall or a photo gallery put up in a restaurant or somebody busking on the sidewalk. Yep. Or, you know, like 60 bands playing at all these venues around town. It's a place where art is really important.
We came because of the scene there. We came from Binghamton, New York and Long Island to play and live in Athens.
But I miss it more than I do, and I dream of empty rooms and the silence that engulfs my hallway too. There's no need for a poem or a letter, cause a note on a postcard just seems so much better. Don't try to change me, don't try to arrange me to fit with your concept of. Cause I'm alone and I long to be lonely. How about you? I'm alone and I long to be lonely.
So you guys lived in New York, were friends up there playing
right.
music.
But you moved to Athens because of, I guess the scene there was REM and B-52s, Pylon, Love Tractor. It was a little bit before Panic, I guess.
Barbecue yeah. Killers.
Okay.
Mercyland.
That's all true. And also Grand Theft Larceny brought us to Athens. That's an exaggeration, but we were in a band up in Binghamton called The Reasonable Men. Mm-hmm. And we were doing okay, sort of struggling along. And then our keyboard player, Farns, suddenly moved to Athens, Georgia.
He just called me on the phone.
All the equipment with the PA. He didn't tell us. His brother was going to law school down there. And yeah, go ahead. He called you?
Yeah, he called me and he said, hey, Mike, I moved to Athens and I have all the gear and I want you to come live with me. And I was like, what? It was like the worst conversation. I was like, I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. I was so mad. I hung up the phone and like for 3 days, I was just fuming. I was enraged. I mean, I really was. And I have no patience for this kind of stuff. Like I control my life. And then, you know, then like, I don't know. I got back on the phone and I was like, dude.
He said, dude, you owe me
$5. I owe you $5. And so, God, I mean, it's just the worst. And I get on the phone with him and I'm like, why? What? And he's like, well, I got this house on Elizabeth Street and it's, and I'm like, well, how much is the rent? And he's like, $74 a month for each of us. And I was like,
if you include Dan's girlfriend,
yeah.
$75 yeah. is what I remember.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I signed a lease, by the way.
And so we moved. Like, we moved immediately. God. I was like, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah, $75 a month.
But
it was full of mice.
What year was this? What,
87.
So this is 1987. How old were y'all?
23,
24.
To be lonely,
yeah.
To be lonely, how long? 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 How long?
So you move to Athens, you end up getting involved into that music scene, and that's where 5/8 was born?
Right, from that. The band immediately broke up after the same guy, Farn, smelled a can of Raid, and it caused the band to break up, as you know, as happens. And then from that, me and Mike formed 5/8. And our old drummer, Mike Pommettier. And that was around 1988. Eventually, we got Patrick Ferguson in the band.
AKA Tigger.
And that's when we started sounding good. Mm-hmm. Like that, to me, that was like 89. That's, for me, that's really when 5/8 really started to like sound good. And this guy was writing excellent songs and he still does today.
Check, 1, 2, Mikey.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
More lead vocal. Yep, that's me. Check.
We're not like other Athens bands. First of all, there's nothing cool about us. And we're like, I don't know, we're like these... seeing
weirdos.
Us, to me, it's like seeing like an exposed kind of raw nerve. You know, it is a different vibe. And it's not for everybody.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like put your, like just get in your face with this kind of like aggressive, almost like obviousness and
yeah.
emotional, like, it was, and the shows were like pretty crazy. I mean, we did some pretty crazy stuff, especially early on.
Is there, when you say pretty crazy stuff, is there a GPB-friendly version you can tell me?
Sure. I mean, we can describe. I mean, yeah, Mike, you just take his clothes off every night, but we're not going to do that here at the interview.
Okay.
I will say that for
not
sure.
This time.
Yeah. Not this time.
We haven't done it in an interview. That has not happened in an interview.
Okay.
Right.
That would be really weird if I did that.
But actually, when you say we did some crazy stuff, like give me an idea, give me a range of what that sounds like. Well, like what is the crazy? Mark may be the one to right. answer it, right?
You can't talk about the Roman candle incident.
No, I would say this, that like me and Mike came from New York and we were raised on classic rock and like our shows were more in your face than your average Athens band then or today.
Yeah.
There was nothing like shoegazing about us.
No.
I mean, for better or for worse, I think we meant it sincerely. We weren't like posing. It's no. just our kind of style. I think that set us apart.
Yeah, pretty much right away.
Even like Frat Boys hired us once.
They would, yeah, they
twice.
Would, we played a lot of frat shows. I would dress up in women's clothing just to get the energy going, and we played some frat shows with me and Drag, and that was pretty fun.
That was fun.
That was great.
Because Mike really does have nice legs too, or he did back then. He'd be like, come on, boys. Like, he was like totally flirting with them.
Yeah, I would flirt with them, and then
that was hysterical.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
When they came to Ellis Island, through Brooklyn and Staten Island, they gave us a voice to be born. Buying fireworks from stands, we're celebrating the man. Though we come from different lands, you'll hear the stories. It's not the 4th of July anymore. No, it's not the 4th of July anymore.
There's a documentary about you guys that's called Weirdo that is named after a song that you have called Weirdo.
Yep.
Are these antics in the documentary?
Not much of what we've talked about today is in there.
Okay. When does the documentary pick up then?
It starts in modern day with them recording their most recent album.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then we flash back to these guys meeting in college. And Mike had this mental health incident that sort of was the birth of a lot of the characters that he writes about in his songs, I'd say. Mm. You know, from that, from being institutionalized and put on Thorazine and being locked in this institution for 5 weeks, you know, he sort of felt like he was destined to just be there for the rest of his life. But his parents pulled him out against doctor's orders, and he picked up a guitar again and started writing songs, and that's all the early 5/8 stuff.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it is dramatic, you know, there in their live shows, there's a real tension. I mean, there's a lot of fun and Dan is hilarious on stage, but these songs are Mike expressing himself and, he has a lot to say and it's some of it's ugly and some of it is beautiful and you kind of don't ever know which way it's going to go. And the tension, especially between the four guys in the band, the tension of feeling like this show could become a disaster at any second, or it could be the greatest thing I've ever seen at any second. That's like always happening, always changing every song. And it's the reason people go see this band and are blown away.
The movie is a lot of like snippets of live shows, but not like any like really long, I would say, concert footage.
Right. It's narrated by interviews. We have 30 something people interviewed in the movie. Mm. You know, all the guys in the band and people who have worked with them and then just a bunch of musicians who these guys look up to, and the musicians like this band also. We have some of the REM guys and Kevin Kinney from Driving and Crying, and Amy Ray from Indigo Girls.
Yeah.
Hugo from Gang of Four.
Yeah.
Bunch of cool people. I think one thing that's complicated about these guys is that Mike's mental health journey, which was kind of the birth of a lot of early 5/8 stuff, is an interesting story, and it's a marketable story. And so record labels would put out, you know, the press releases and that look like doctor's orders, basically. And this, you know, so there became an aspect of always bringing up this event, this terrible event in Mike's life. It's an important event. And, you know, if I describe my movie to people, I include that event in the, like, three mm-hmm. sentences that I say. But for a person who's trying to heal and trying to grow, having to tap into that at every live show is, you know, maybe not the best idea, not the best thing for your mental health, you know?
Yeah.
But it was a way to put on amazing rock shows.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of pressure. And I think we talk about it in the movie, about what it was like to, for me as a performer. And, you know, just play music. And I think a lot of the songs sort of go in that direction, but there's sort of a tongue-in-cheekness to it too. I mean, I kind of don't take myself that seriously, but I sometimes, you know, it just, I don't know, just would tap into this thing that was sort of unpredictable, and I think somewhat dangerous. So I know, like, I think about songs like I'm Depressed Almost All the Time, or like, which is kind of, you know, it's a funny title, you know, I'm Depressed Almost All the Time, you know, and I sing it's kind of funny, but there was this truth to it that's kind of tragic that also is there. So it's kind of, you know, layered, you know.
I mean, Behead Myself is another one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Behead Myself. It's like, I would always, it would amaze me. We'd play the 40 watt and there'd be like 500 people there and they'd be singing along to a song like, I'm going to behead myself, you know? And it's just like, because I think in a sense, you know, maybe people identify with that kind of feeling somehow, but I couldn't understand how they really did. It was like,
Once saints taught us things, MLK Street of dreams, now we find with such ease, precious long guns, if you please, in this time of disease, throwing bricks with such peace, yeah, we lie in a tweet of your love and deceit. It's not the 4th of July anymore. No, it's not the 4th of July.
I have some regrets, and I think the stuff that happens with Sean, I feel like I wasn't able to support him as much as I could have, and I didn't know, and so this, like, that was tough. I think that stuff kind of hurt a little.
Oh, what happened there?
Oh, he got attacked and was hurt very badly, and
he was trying to, the guy tried to murder him. It was some sort of crazy.
It was a break-in.
Yeah, it was a break-in.
And he was sleeping. It's in the movie, and we didn't, you know, we were so busy, and we had so many bookings back then that we didn't, you know, we didn't really stop to help Sean recover the way we should have. I agree with that too. We knew he had suffered and he was struggling, but we didn't know how much.
this attack put sort of just sent Sean in this spiral that was really hard to get out of, and it took him years.
Yeah.
And you know, the size of band that they were at that time meant they were often sleeping when they were on the road all the time,
yeah,
but also sleeping on floors and almost always with people you don't really know very well.
Right.
And Sean just needed a safe space to be in for months probably. And, there just wasn't a way to stay in the band and take that time off. And I think none of these guys really knew, you know, how important an event this would turn out to be.
Yeah. It is hard because, you know, for anyone who's in basically show business, you know, you do have that attitude. The show must go on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have that attitude today. Like, I just want to play, mm-hmm, and play as much as I can. And to me, that in itself is a positive act and good for me. But it's not necessarily good for everybody all the time. And sometimes it would do me well to take a step back and realize that too, that we're all individuals and we have our needs and they don't always match up, you know?
I suspect that Sean wouldn't have wanted to stop. Like, even if we had said, let's stop, mm-hmm, he would have been like, that would have been the worst thing.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
So, yeah.
Because I think that part of it was just we wanted to be together, and I think he felt safe with people around him. But at the same time, you know, you just don't realize that kind of attack where you're almost murdered. I mean, I have no way of identifying what that would have felt like. I have no way of relating to it. So but I do, I watch it in the movie and I'm like, ugh.
Oh, it's definitely like, I mean, this movie gets really dark, and that's the darkest point for me.
But it is very funny. I mean,
yeah, I get,
you know, most people talk to me about how funny they thought it was.
Good.
Yeah.
I like that Mark over here is like, whoa. It's not super dark. Like, it's not that dark. Like, yeah, like there's some happy parts about it. Let's,
yeah.
You want people to watch it.
Yeah. Around the part where someone is almost murdered, it's, yeah.
That part is tough.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
The guy with the mental health problems.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and
just
yeah,
like,
the guy
just,
the so there's an the, almost murder. There's somebody being institutionalized.
Yeah.
There's addiction problems.
See, there's addiction problems. Okay, see.
It's no problem. Fun, it's really fun.
Family film. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds amazing.
But really, the thing, my favorite thing about the movie when I think back on it is the idea that these guys have survived all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was really impressed with how grateful they are to be alive and to be in this band and to be friends with each other after almost 40 years now.
Yeah.
That gratitude I don't know, it kind of blows me away. And I don't know, I try to be grateful more in my life because I knew these guys.
Well, thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's sweet.
We descended from thieves to smell fire in the tree. Water eyes on the beach, mask on out of reach. Lines drawn in the sand, your rifle held in your hand. Tan each other to a man, just try it, try it. I'm the last one to flee. I got a house and family on this blue dot in a sea of red. Tempers and temperatures, temptations, rapturous, hateism, racism, face down in the dirt, nationalism. It's not the 4th of July. Anymore.
When I Google the 5/8 documentary,
yeah,
there are headlines that say Athens legend gets documentary art. Documentary highlights Athens legends. Are y'all legends in Athens, Georgia?
Dan is.
It's hard to when someone gives me a compliment that I'm like embarrassed.
There's an Athens Music Walk of Fame. It's like the, you know, the stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and 5/8 just got theirs.
It's a guitar pick in the sidewalk.
Yeah,
and it says 5/8.
Yeah,
so from the city. We're in that sidewalk forever. I was saying, even Godzilla will come through and he can smash the buildings, do his usual stuff.
Yep.
High tension wires, buildings. Usually he picks up a bus or a train. Mm-hmm. And everyone's
people,
inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he stomps some things. But he probably, he usually leaves the sidewalk alone.
Yeah.
I was telling Calvin, who also has this. He has a pick of fame also.
Yeah, Calvin's great.
Lucky for us, like, Godzilla is not that detail oriented, right, that he gets in the, doesn't roll up the sidewalk.
Sure.
We were worried about graffiti.
You think so?
Oh. Yeah, I do.
Well, someone defaced one of our posters
recently. But it was like a middle school thing. You know, it really brought me right back to middle. But it was middle school. It was middle school humor.
It had a photograph of Mike with a microphone. Only in the artwork, that wasn't a microphone.
Gotcha. Yep.
You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. This is not. Yeah. This is like what. This is what messed me up in school, was that kind of defacing, you know, just abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was joking about it. I hope that doesn't happen.
Because that was my entire formative years, was just getting beat up by people, and then they would draw things on your yearbook and put stuff on your back, kick Mike, you know, that kind of thing.
My hope.
says, there's a mournful look. I remember the sleepless nights, dark brown eyes in circles of black, my feathered hair blown dried straight. Now you'd think someone else had gone crazy, but I did, and I'm your weirdo, weirdo, weirdo. Well, what I said, I thought it was funny. What I did, I tried to be cool. And what I show is my impersonation of you all. And I'm your weirdo.
So I met 5'8 about 20 years ago. I worked as a morning show producer in Atlanta at 99X, and you guys played some parties for us, and you came in studio and did some stuff.
That was with Rizzy.
Yes, with Rizzy, and who came in for a special episode of Peach Jam with John Driscoll Hopkins.
Yes.
So I got to catch up with him. So I met you guys when you had a song on the radio. Yeah. You were making a run at like alternative radio.
Yeah.
And then you got to open for REM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
That was a big break. That was in the movie too.
Yeah.
That was really awesome.
I think it was like me and Dan sticking together. It was like the band, you know, after the attack. And we'd put out this record that was with Walter Yetnikoff of Velvel Records. He was the guy that they wrote Hitman about. And this guy wined and dined the band, dropped like $150,000 on us in an advance, and did nothing with the record for 2 years. And after that, Patrick quit. We kind of, me and I had to kind of fire Sean. I had no idea what was going on, but
he was kind of... I totally thought Sean just quit until I saw the movie.
Yeah, no, I called him up. He doesn't remember it either, but he wouldn't. Anyway, it was bad. I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. I was like, dude, we're just going to go on, me and Dan, and we're going to try and find a drummer. And that was that. And then...
because we had made,
Dan had talked me into that.
So the Black record, just fill you in, the Black record that came out after The Good Nurse was the album that the REM guys all heard, REM and Burtis, right? Yeah. And they called us up and they wanted us to tour with them. It's stringent. They all have to like it.
Yeah.
That's their rule. And it's a good rule. I like the way that band does business. They're very, very cool. Anyone like wants to put them down, and I'm like, because they were so good to us. You know, I mean, that was one of the best weeks of our life, opening for REM out west. Oh my God, the Greek Theater. And like the first night they saw us do it, the rodeo, the techie, I should say, he saw us coming in with our little rented amps, and they were, him and Mike Mills, they were all like, why don't you just use our stuff? And I'm like, okay. So we returned all the, and every night after that, I got to use Mike Mills. He had two SVTs on stage side by side. One was a backup. He didn't play through both at once. One was there for him, and one was a backup, and I played through that backup every night. All I had to bring was my bass. And, you know, a couple of cables. Oh, my God. And they paid us well, and we had delicious catering every night. We ate their catering. And it was, and then, of course, you're playing. We're used to playing these little clubs, and all of a sudden we're playing in front of 6,000 to 8,000 people every night. And for those guys, these were small venues. They wanted a more intimate tour.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, well, nothing small about that.
That was great.
Nothing small. There were a lot of outdoor amphitheaters like the Greek Theater in L.A. or that place in Santa Barbara. It's like Santa Barbara Bowl or something.
Yeah. Anyway, it was awesome.
I mean, and we were like out west. We played, you know, 4 shows in California and one in Albuquerque and one in Seattle.
Yeah.
it was just like a dream come true, start to finish.
Yeah.
And we did good shows, you know? We honed it down. We were like, we knew we better not screw this up.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, he really had the audience in his palm because we, I mean, a lot of it, like I said to Mike and Izzy, I'm like, well, let's just find out if a bar band like us can entertain 8,000 people at once. And one thing he did that was so cool was he started Weirdo and went off mic and just sang it. His voice can get very loud. And he filled up the Greek Theater with his voice and his guitar, just soft, you know. And man, you could hear a pin drop. It brought him right in. It was a great move. I thought it was a really good thing.
Yeah.
That was cool. And then, you know,
stolen from Jonathan Richman.
Oh yeah.
My hero.
Totally stolen from Jonathan Richman. That off the
mic
technique.
Yeah.
Yeah, John, yeah. I mean, everyone, you gotta steal from the best.
That's
and
right.
And Jonathan Richman is the best.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, you can find 5/8 Music start to finish on GPB's YouTube page. And don't forget to leave a quick rating and review both on YouTube and where you're listening to this podcast. It helps more than you know. And if you like what we're doing here on Peach Jam, please tell somebody. Tell your friends, tell your neighbor, tell your pastor, your mailman. Do you know a band that needs to be on the show? Tell them. And if this is your first time here, I invite you to go back and listen to some of the other episodes. You might just find that your next favorite band lives right down the road. Coming up on the next episode of Peach Jam, you'll meet a young man with a powerful voice.
Being my age, I'm the youngest person in this genre right now pursuing it.
Skylar Peterson is on the next episode of the Peach Jam Podcast. The Peach Jam Podcast is produced, edited, and hosted by me, Jeremy Powell. If you want to recommend an artist to be on the show, send me an email, peachjam@gpb.org. Sandy Malcolm is our executive producer. Mark Davenport is our associate producer. Recording, mixing, and mastering by David Spence and Victoria Evans Cash. Special thanks to the team at Sounds Good. Find us on Instagram at Peach Jam Podcast and look for Peach Jam on TV wherever you watch Georgia Public Broadcasting. In the meantime, please support live local music and independent record stores in your area.